fuse, but she nodded.
Yes, Mama. I am quite finished here.
In spite of her thickening figure, her walk was still graceful. She did not look back. When the door had closed behind her, Mrs. Marshwood turned on us.
Bowles described the man who had come to see her. It required little imagination to realize it must be you, she said,
her tone cold as she addressed Stoker, her mouth curled in distaste.
I'm surprised to find you here, Revelstoke. I thought never to see you again.
He said nothing for a long moment, the seconds ticking past in the beat of my pulse. The woman had not acknowledged my presence, and a person of delicacy would have excused herself from what could only be a painful and private conversation. But delicacy has never been one of my failings. Stoker was my friend, and I would not give ground if there was a chance he had need of me. He lowered his chin, and when he spoke it was in a voice of such quiet intensity, such controlled rage, that I knew he was very near to breaking something.
You really mean to let her carry on with this ridiculous charade of being insensible? You cannot imagine the police will be put off by such a stratagem.
She shook her head, causing the blackbird's wing to tremble.
They have thus far. It is an untenable situation, and we are coping as best we can. Her husband is missing, and the authorities have misused her cruelly. If they believed they could get more information from her, they would hound her night and day. At least now she is left in peace.
The woman's gaze flicked to me for the first time.
I think this interview is best conducted in private.
Anything you would say to me, I will only repeat to my associate. Miss Speedwell stays.
She curled her lip again as she took the measure of me from top to toe.
Very well. Miss Speedwell stays.
She glanced about the mouldering greenhouse.
I will not offer you refreshment, she told Stoker, nor will I ask you to make yourself comfortable. I am an old woman, and I have no stomach for this business. State your purpose and be gone.
He tipped his head, his gaze glacial.
How remiss of me. Permit me to make formal introductions. Mrs. Marshwood, this is Miss Speedwell, a fellow employee of Lord Rosemorin's and my colleague. Veronica, this is Mrs. Marshwood, as you have no doubt deduced, my mother-in-law.
Former, she corrected swiftly, for which I thank God upon my knees.
No more than I,
he replied.
She bridled at that.
I told you to state your purpose.
Stoker said nothing, and I spoke.
Mrs. Marshwood, we are investigating the disappearance of Mr. De Morgan.
Investigating, she said,
her lips thinning into an unpleasant smile.
Revelstoke Templeton Vane has no place here, she said,
the wing on her hat trembling in outrage.
We might be allies, I began.
Allies?
She gave a sharp shake of the head, nearly dislodging her fur.
That is a pretty word to use to a lady. We have no need of the help of outsiders, and even if we did, to accept aid from him, of all people.
She carried on in this vein for some time, while I let my thoughts wander to the conservatory and how it might be improved. Mrs. Marshwood continued her litany of abuse until I turned to Stoker.
I thought she would run out of air by now, but she has rather impressive lung capacity for such an elderly person. Do you think she will come to the point any time soon?
Not that this isn't entertaining, but I really ought to get back to work. I have a delectable little Bassaris gonorilla that needs fixing. It is so difficult to get specimens from New Zealand, I should hate to lose this one, I remarked. Mrs. Marshwood cut off her diatribe to fix me with a look of loathing.
You are an impertinent person, and no better than you should be, I would wager, working with a man of such notorious reputation, she said with a shudder. It is not respectable.
I waved a hand,
Respectability is as overrated as virginity, madam, and I have precious little use for either. Now, Stoker has done a remarkable job of holding the reins of his temper throughout your abuses, but I cannot promise he will sustain the effort. In fact, I should encourage him not to. I turned to Stoker. Would you like me to give her a good shake? Nothing to leave a mark, just a bit of firm handling to bring her to the point. Mrs. Marshwood's hat trembled in rage.
Odious creature!
She launched into another venomous monologue, criticizing my morals and appearance before returning to the subject of her former son-in-law's shortcomings. Stoker took it, stoically accepting every bit of abuse she heaped upon him, arms folded over his chest as he regarded his mother-in-law. Bored with her acidulous remarks, I cut in swiftly, interrupting her in full flow. "What do you think happened to John de Morgan?" I asked. She blinked furiously.
"What happened to him? He ran away, of course. He stole that diadem and abandoned my daughter."
"Are you certain of that?" I asked. "Mrs. de Morgan doesn't seem to think so." Mrs. Marshwood curled her lip in distaste.
"I am not answerable to you, Miss Speedwell."
I ignored the provocation. Frankly, it was not one of her better ones. "Mrs. Marshwood, do try to use a little intelligence, taxing as it may be," I instructed. "There is no proof that John de Morgan stole the diadem and abandoned his wife. No one knows what has become of him. Surely the truth, no matter how painful, would be better than this current state of affairs."
"My daughter's welfare is none of your concern," she returned.
"On that we are in complete agreement," I told her. "But the facts behind De Morgan's disappearance must be established. Your daughter cannot even be declared a legal widow without a body," I pointed out. The old woman reared back, her thin lips suddenly bloodless.
"Caroline cannot be left in a state of limbo. It is intolerable."
"Then help us discover what happened to her husband," I urged. She said nothing, but her mouth worked furiously as she gnawed her own lips. After a moment, I sighed. "Never mind, Stoker. Mrs. Marshwood will not be persuaded to see reason. Let us take our leave." I extracted a card of my own and left it lying upon the garden seat. "You may reach us at that address, should you change your mind." She curled a lip.
"I ought to lodge a complaint with the police that you have forced your way into our home uninvited. It would serve you right."
Stoker, who had moved to leave, turned back. The leafy shadows of the ferns played over his face like jagged fingers, giving him a menacing look. And when he spoke, it was in a quietly terrifying voice I had never heard before.
"Before you do, think of everything you have said about me. Every evil act you have attributed to me. Every sin you have laid at my door. Recite to yourself my catalogue of cruelties, and ask yourself if you really want to provoke me."
Mrs. Marshwood shrank back, her lips trembling. She lifted a bony finger that shook with rage and fear.
"Go!"
We did not look back. Chapter 10. We returned to the Belvedere in silence, and I had not even divested myself of my coat before Stoker had shed his, drawn the cork on a bottle, and splashed a hefty measure into a tooth mug. "Stoker," I began. He held up the mug, sloshing the contents.
"Drink with me, or get the hell out," he ordered.
I held out my hand, and he gave me the tooth mug, then drank straight from the bottle. He stalked up the small staircase to the snuggery on the upper floor, kicking a fossilized coprolite out of his way as he went. He flung himself into a chair while I stirred the fire and hung my hat. Between swallows of extremely expensive single malt, he wrenched off his collar and necktie, waistcoat and cuffs, flinging them aside. I took the chair opposite, pacing my sips. "Would it do any good to apologize?" I asked finally. He tipped his head.
"I am not one of your bloody butterflies, Veronica."
"I never thought..."
"Yes, you did."
He tipped the bottle up, taking another deep draught of whiskey.
"You like to think you are smarter than everyone else, and the bloody hell of it is that you usually are. You like to put people into little boxes, just like those bollocking moths, a pin through the thorax and pop them up on a bit of card to look at when you're bored."
I stared into the fire, saying nothing.
"You think you know me. You have me all sorted. Homo sapiens ex salutis. It has quite the ring, doesn't it?"
"Your Latin is filthy," I replied, keeping my tone light. "I should have said vulneraverunt." He gave a mirthless laugh.
"Even now you cannot be wrong. But you are. You are so unbelievably, unbearably wrong."
I nearly turned my head then. I nearly turned and told him that I did understand him. I knew he loved Caroline. He loved her with a passion that excused everything she had done to him and was not blunted. Perhaps he loved her the more for her cruelties, I reflected. It would be a sad irony if he did. How appallingly tragic to carry a torch for a woman who had abandoned him and exposed the secrets of his unkindnesses to public scrutiny. But how often do we learn to kiss the boot that kicks us? He went on in a bitter voice.
"I am glad you saw her. She is beautiful, is she not? Like an angel come to earth. That's what I thought the first time I saw her. It is the most appalling cliché, but it suits her. She is not of this earth. That is what a poet would tell you. I was shy with her. Can you imagine that? The first time I put out my hand to touch her, it shook. The hand that had killed men in battle and saved men in surgery, and it shook to touch her. What sinner would dare to touch the hem of the saint's gown?"
I let him speak, but that silence cost me dearly. Each word out of his mouth was a laceration, flaying me to the bone as he talked on, listing her perfections. And the worst of it was that he spoke the truth. She was the loveliest creature I had ever seen. Menelaus might launch 1,000 ships to reclaim Helen, but the gods themselves would have quarrelled over Caroline de Morgan.
"I never felt worthy of her,"
he said, after another deep pull at the bottle.
"Not once. She was so unspoilt and shy. We hardly spoke two words alone before I got down on my knees in a moonlit garden and begged her to marry me. She was too timid even to answer me for herself. She ran to her mother, who gave me the happy news. The day I married her should have been the happiest of my life, but it wasn't. Do you know why? Do you?"
he demanded, reaching out a booted foot to nudge my chair. I held quite still.
"Because I never really believed she was mine. I did not deserve anything so beautiful for my very own. I knew what I was. My father. My mother. My dirty little soul was just a patchwork of compromises and lies and desperate acts, tainted from birth by other people's deceptions. But I asked, and she came. She married me, and I carried her off to Brazil. I thought, fool that I was, that it would be a grand, romantic adventure."
He broke off, his gaze unfocused. He was not with me then, sitting in the snuggery of the Belvedere, with a cold British February outside and a warm fire within. He was tramping the jungles of Amazonia with his best friend and his beautiful bride. I cleared my throat. "Jungles and mud and crocodiles," I said lightly. I don't know that I much blame her for going back to England without you. I suppose it was gentlemanly of him to escort her home if she were unhappy at travelling in so wild a place. He tipped his head, his smile cold.
My dear Veronica, you don't understand. She did not leave with him. She left me for him.
He pierced me with his gaze.
Don't you see? I was never the one she wanted. I took her for my wife, and I thought it meant that God understood, that God forgave what I was. Just a filthy little changeling bastard. That's what my brothers called me, and they were right. I was nothing more than the product of some frantic tumbling by people who ought never to have given in to their lusts. You, of all people, understand that, don't you, Veronica?
I thrust myself out of the chair. I went to the stove and took up the empty coal hod and placed it carefully next to his chair. You've drunk an appalling amount. If you mean to be sick, do it there. I'll not clean up after you. I did not look behind me as I left, but his laughter followed me down the stairs and into the darkness. The next morning I had no stomach for work. I began a dozen projects and cursed them aside, furious at myself, at Caroline de Morgan, and thoroughly out of charity with Stoker. I could bear anything except his self-loathing. I was ripe for a diversion, and when the note arrived from Lady Tiverton inviting me to meet her at the Curiosity Club, I was on my feet and reaching for my hat before I finished reading. The Curiosity Club was a unique establishment. Formerly known as the Hippolyta Club, its purpose was the edification and support of women of adventure and accomplishment. Membership was strictly private and by invitation only, and I had been permitted to darken its hallowed halls only once before as a guest of Lord Rosemoren's sister. I longed to return, and even if I had not been eager for Lady Tiverton's company, the lure of the club itself would have been sufficient. The day had dawned bright with a valiant winter sun doing its best to banish the coal fog and grey clouds that scudded on the horizon. The banked snow at the edge of the pavement was grimy with soot and other unspeakable things, but now and again I caught a glimpse through a garden gate of a pristine stretch of white, glittering in the sunlight. Almost against my will, I felt my spirits rise as I strode up the front steps of the club and rang the bell. A discreet scarlet plaque identified the club. But apart from that, it was a perfectly ordinary townhouse in a perfectly ordinary square. The door was opened by the portress in scarlet plush. I recognized her from my previous visit, but before I could speak, she smiled.
Miss Speedwell, welcome back to the Hippolyta Club.
Thank you, Hetty. She stood back to admit me, signaling to a page to take my coat as she closed the door upon the winter chill. Inside, all was crimson warmth, from the thick carpets to the blazing fireplaces in the public rooms. The walls, draped in dark red silk, were hung with assorted photographs from members' expeditions, as well as sailing charts, maps, and a rare collection of memorabilia from around the world. Over it all presided Hetty, the serene face of the Hippolyta Club. She wore a shawl wrapped elegantly around her head. A fine bit of Chinese silk in a shade of deep blue that flattered the dark colour of her skin. Her eyes were dark as well, and sharply attentive to every detail of the club. She indicated the leather ledger with a smile.
Lady Tiverton has already signed you in, Miss Speedwell. She is awaiting you in the map room.
I thanked her, and was just turning to follow the page when Hetty called, "A moment, Miss Speedwell." She reached below the desk where she presided, bringing out an envelope of thick, creamy paper, sealed with a bit of scarlet wax and the emblem of the club, the letters H and C entwined in an Amazon's bow, with the legend Alis Volat Propriis circling the perimeter. She proffered it with a grave smile. "A message for me?" I took it, noting my name inscribed in an elegant hand in a swirl of crimson ink.
An invitation. You have been proposed for membership to the club, and this is the official notice.
My heart thudded against my ribs.
Proposed for membership? But Lady Cordelia never said...
I broke off, thinking how curious it was that the Earl's sister should think of such a thing, while she was stuck in Cornwall, supervising the education of her brother's children. But Hetty shook her head, setting the fringe of her turban to swinging.
It was not Lady Cordelia, although she provided the necessary second to the nomination for membership. You were put forward by Her Royal Highness the Princess Louise.
I smiled in spite of myself.
My last interview with my aunt had not been pleasant. Stoker and I had undertaken our last investigation at her behest, and she had been a less than appreciative beneficiary of our efforts. She had also made it clear that our association was not to continue. I would not be presented to my father, nor would she receive me publicly. But this was no little thing, I realized, as I slipped the envelope into my pocket. This club was her sanctuary, and to admit me here was almost a more intimate act than introducing me to the family.
Thank you, Hetty.
The favour of a reply is requested within a week's time, she told me.
She gestured for the page to guide me to Lady Tiverton. The map room was located on the ground floor, just behind the stairs, a high-ceilinged chamber that overlooked the back garden, its aspect bleak just now with the leaves stripped bare and the limbs of the trees blackened with cold. But the fire was built high, and the lamps glowed warmly, casting an amber light over the walls hung with enormous maps of the known world, the British bits picked out in pink, a chain of pearly possessions girdling the waist of the world. Pairs of deep leather chairs were scattered about the room, but Lady Tiverton had chosen a sofa, a handsome Chesterfield drawn close to the fire. A low tea table stood in front of it, and on that rested a tray of light refreshments and a bowl of chrysanthemums, the petals a rare shade of deep blue-red.
"It is pleasant, is it not?"
she asked, as she rose to greet me.
"All the colour seems to banish the grey of winter, and I feel almost warm."
She gestured for me to join her on the sofa, and I settled myself against a flame-stitched cushion. "Do you suffer from the English climate?" I asked. She nodded.
"Dreadfully. I was brought up in Egypt, you know, and every winter was spent with my mother's family. My father's people were Scots, and a winter there was not to be borne," she added with a smile.
She moved to offer me some refreshment, and I took the chance to study her. She was dressed once more in grey, but this gown was fashioned of heavy velvet, only a year or two out of date, and she had pinned the scarab at her throat.
"Your brooch is very unusual," I told her, "and quite lovely."
One graceful hand went to the jewel.
"A heart scarab," she told me. "They are buried with mummies. It is said that in the afterlife, the goddess Maat weighs the heart of the dead. If the heart is as light as her feather, the dead will be given entry into the fields of Hetep and Iaru."
"Hetep and Iaru?"
"Think of the Elysian fields of Greek myth," she instructed.
"What happens if the heart of the dead is heavier than the feather?" I asked.
She gave a little shudder.
"Then the heart of the dead will be snatched and devoured by Amit. He is a monstrous creature with the head of a crocodile and the body of a lion."
"Monstrous indeed."
The ghost of a smile touched her lips.
"Even more when you know that Amit's back legs are those of a hippopotamus. He is called the Gobbler because he does nothing but sit and wait,
to gorge himself on the hearts of the unworthy.
What, then, is the purpose of the heart scarab? I asked.
It is inscribed with prayers. Please to the heart to weigh lightly, so that the dead may walk freely into the afterlife.
She touched the scarab at her throat with a light fingertip.
I admired this particular piece, so my husband had it fashioned into a brooch as an engagement present.
A generous and thoughtful gift, I said.
A trifle ghoulish, you mean,
she said with a knowing look.
But it suits me far better than more conventional jewels. It is a piece of my history, after all.
We fell silent a moment, and her ladyship kept her finger resting upon the scarab brooch, stroking the dark green stone absently. Then she roused herself, setting a smile to her lips.
I believe congratulations are in order, she said brightly. I understand you have been put up for membership.
Yes, I was rather surprised, but pleasantly so.
And with such a sponsor, she added. Her Royal Highness has never before nominated a member. She must hold you very dear.
I made a non-committal noise, and Lady Tiverton went on.
I hope you do not mind my inviting you without Mr. Templeton Vane. Only I find sometimes it is easier for ladies to speak without the interference of gentlemen.
Her expression was very nearly apologetic, and I gave her an encouraging look. Do you have something to tell me? About the investigation? I asked. She spread her hands.
I rather hoped you would have something to tell me. The newspapers have been full of such dreadful stories.
She broke off and looked at me expectantly. You mean about Mr. Templeton Vane? I supplied. A faint touch of colour rose in her cheeks.
I do not mean to suggest that he is guilty of any of the atrocities the newspapers report. In fact, having met him, I cannot imagine him guilty of any of them.
He is not, I returned sharply. She gentled her voice.
And it does you credit as his friend and associate that you believe him. Having spent time in proximity with the De Morgans, I can only say that I found them to be a most unusual couple.
How so? She hesitated, searching for the proper words, it seemed.
If I were a painter, choosing a couple to stand together in a painting, I would have selected them out of a thousand. They were striking. Her with a sort of ethereal blondness, and him darkly handsome. You could not help but look at them when they appeared together. They were so attractive. And they were clearly devoted, in spite of their quarrels.
Some couples seem to thrive upon conflict, I remarked mildly. Heaven knew Stoker and I were none too gentle with one another, although we were certainly not a pair in the conventional sense of the word. Her ladyship nodded slowly.
I suppose what you say is right. My own parents were frequently quarrelsome, but a more devoted couple you cannot imagine. I could never be content with such an arrangement. I have a horror of scenes and dramatics.
I chose my words carefully. Sir Leicester is a very energetic man, I ventured. She smiled,
but never out of temper with me. I had the advantage of seeing him for many years in the intimacy of his first marriage. He was always kind and solicitous towards the first Lady Tiverton. I never intended to marry, she confided. Such a thing seemed beyond possibility. When he proposed, it was the most absurd good fortune. I promised myself I would always be as serene and peaceful a helpmeet as I could. I owed him that much.
I had not expected her to be so forthcoming about her marriage, but it suddenly occurred to me in a flash of intuition that Lady Tiverton was lonely. Lady Welly had suggested that Sir Leicester's friends had not all been accommodating of his new connection. I wondered how many friendships had been sacrificed because people could not reconcile his marriage to this tranquil and kindly woman. I decided to trespass a little on that kindness and venture an indiscreet question or two. You were a sort of companion to the first Lady Tiverton, were you not?
Indeed,
she said promptly. When she spoke of her husband's first wife, she did so with real warmth.
Or rather, a secretary companion. I attended to her correspondence, helped her to write her books.
I understand she was ill for much of her life.
Consumption, a dreadful way to go,
she said, her eyes suddenly bleak.
It is a terrible thing to witness in a person you love, and I will own that I loved the first Lady Tiverton. She was like an elder sister to me. We shared confidences and secrets. Oh, nothing important, just silly things. But they meant everything to me. She told me once, when she had grown very weak, that she feared most of all leaving Sir Leicester behind.
Not her child?
I asked sharply.
She shrugged.
Lady Tiverton always said Figgy took after her, resourceful and clever, and a child whose mother has been ill for the greater part of her life is not surprised by death. Sir Leicester, however, always seemed to think the worst would never happen. That somehow she would go on forever, just as she always had. It came as the most wretched shock to him when she died.
But you were able to console each other, I suggested, careful to keep my voice neutral. She folded her hands together.
Impossible. He was inconsolable. I sometimes think if it weren't for the work, he might have done something terrible to himself.
The work. I felt impatient with the Tivertons, people who had made a child and seemed to give her no more thought than a stray dog. His daughter was not consolation enough? I could not hide the touch of asperity in my voice. She shrugged again.
Sir Leicester adores Figgy, but he does not always know how to handle her. Particularly now. She is at such a difficult age, half a child, half a woman. He tries to talk to her, but most often they end up in a quarrel. I have hopes she will grow out of it. I make allowances because she has lost her mother.
And does not accept you in the role of replacement? She looked aghast.
I would never presume. You must understand. Figgy is like the wards, her mother's people. They are very self-contained, very stoic. It was only because of the effects of her illness and her medications that the first Lady Tiverton ever spoke as openly to me as she did. She very much just got on with things, as she had been taught, as she taught Figgy.
As you now do, I observed. Her lips parted, then pressed together, as if she were about to say something, then thought better of it. It can be a thankless and tiresome task, always being the person who holds the world together, I said gently. Her smile was wan.
If I do not, who will? I promised the first Lady Tiverton that I would always take care of Sir Leicester. It was a deathbed vow, and one I will keep until the end of my days. She knew how important the work was to him. She knew how much he needed someone to support him in his work, to look after him. That is why it is so essential that the exhibition goes forward.
Is there a danger of its being cancelled? Her hands were still folded neatly in her lap, but the knuckles were white, the skin stretched taut over the bone.
I fear that if the newspapers make too much of this, if there are too many more stories of the curse, that somehow it will be ruined.
Surely the opposite will happen, I argued. The more people talk about the curse, the more they will want to see the collection. Whoever this J.J. Butterworth is, Sir Leicester owes him a debt of gratitude. He is single-handedly providing the expedition with more press than you could ever possibly purchase.
I suppose,
she said, but her expression was doubtful.
I cannot rid myself of the fear that something else is at work here, something darker.
You cannot mean that you believe the curse might be real? Her lips thinned.
I am half Egyptian, Miss Speedwell, but I assure you my education was not neglected. I know there is no such thing as a curse. Whatever is done in this world is done by the hands of men.
There was something chilling in her words, and I swallowed hard. You fear an enemy?
I do not know what I fear,
she burst out, the tranquil facade deserting her briefly. She drew in a deep breath, mastering herself.
Forgive me. My nerves are worked to pieces.
And still you are one of the most composed women of my acquaintance, I told her truthfully.
Composure that is hard won and the result of long practice, she assured me. I learned long ago that when one is only half British, the other half will be blamed for every evil of temper or habit. I schooled myself in deportment so that the part of me that is Egyptian may never be held up as a pattern for degradation or vice. I became more British than any Englishwoman I knew, and still every syllable I speak, every gesture, every thought is examined by society. I could take tea with the Queen at Windsor every day, and twice on Sundays, and I would still not be English enough for some.
She spoke without bitterness, but there was a fatigue to her resignation, and I began to understand the weight she carried with her at all times. Sir Leicester, I hope, appreciates the difficulties you have faced.
Sir Leicester is blind to them, she said simply. For all his faults, he is without bigotry, and I honor him for that. He would never register a slight, because he would never inflict one.
A noble thing, but it means you must contend alone with whatever insults you encounter.
A small price to pay, Miss Speedwell. After all, I am content in the love of the man I esteem most in the world. Can every woman say the same?
I wonder if Caroline de Morgan can, I mused.
I cannot imagine her fear, her confusion, just now, she said,
the knuckles turning whiter still.
Not to know what has become of her husband. I only hope that she may be provided with an answer. However painful the truth, it must be preferred to the horror of not knowing.
And all the more necessary now, I said carefully. Caroline de Morgan is going to have a child. Lady Tiverton paled.
How do you know that?
Mr. Templeton Vane and I called upon her yesterday. She is in seclusion with her parents, but we managed to gain entry. If I had to guess, I would say she is in her 5th month. Lady Tiverton covered her face with her hands and said nothing. No sniffle, no sob broke the silence, only the rhythmic ticking of the mantel clock, measuring off seconds and heartbeats. "You did not know?" I asked. At last, Lady Tiverton lifted her head.
"No. She wore her gowns rather loose, but many do in Egypt to throw off the heat. I am sorry to hear she is expect." She said, "I cannot think that bringing a child into her present situation is at all desirable."
"I think she is happy," I said. "If her husband is dead, she has some remnant of him in his child. Of course, if he has deserted her..."
"He has not," she said flatly. "I did not know him well, but intimacy grows quickly in the field. I saw enough of him to know a little of his character, and John de Morgan loved his wife, and he loved children. His dearest wish was to become a father."
"How do you know this?" I asked. Her voice was dull, and she spoke as if she were reciting facts by rote.
"At dinner one night. It was Patrick Fairbrother's birthday, and I had asked the cook to make him a cake. He blew out the candles and made a wish, and we fell to talking about wishes. Mr. De Morgan was seated next to me, and he confided that he hoped above all things that he and his wife would be so blessed."
"Did anyone else hear the conversation?"
"No."
She fell silent again, but I could tell her thoughts were working furiously. After a long moment, she seemed to come to some sort of decision, for she rose abruptly.
"Perhaps you would like to accompany me to Karnak Hall. I must see how preparations for the exhibition are progressing, and you might enjoy a little foretaste of our efforts."
"Thank you, my lady. I would indeed." We secured a hansom and very shortly were being whisked through the streets towards the hall. The route took us down a major shopping street where traffic was thicker and our pace was slowed. I did not mind, for the delay afforded us a chance to look at the gaily decorated windows of the shops. The display of a fashionable milliner caught my eye. "Look there, my lady, a decidedly Egyptological homage," I said, nodding towards the window. A trio of hats was featured, each fashioned in a distinctive motif. One had lotus flowers and a ribbon trim printed with hieroglyphics. Another was vaguely shaped like a pharaoh's headdress, with lappets to frame the face, and the third was a red wicker affair surmounted by a stuffed vulture.
"That may well be the most hideous thing I have ever seen," Lady Tiverton said acidly, "and I have seen a jackal eating a cat."
I grinned. "It is dreadful. Do you suppose anyone will actually buy it?" She shook her head.
"I would hope not. Good taste ought to count for something. But I am told our expedition has generated quite a fashion for such atrocities. Heaven help us, Miss Speedwell, but we are modish."
In a short while we drew up in front of Karnak Hall, a modest exhibition facility of some antiquity in a street just off Leicester Square. The hall had been built in the style of its namesake temple, the edifice set with a series of recesses, each featuring a great statue of Ramses in a different pose. The rest of the facade was painted terracotta to resemble the walls of the temple, and decorated with fanciful Egyptological friezes. We passed between the legs of one of the Ramses to enter, and I resisted the urge to look up. The front doors of the hall led into a wide foyer, a sort of anteroom to the main exhibition space. Workmen were clattering about with lumber and hammers, making an unholy din. But even above the noise I could hear the outraged voice of Sir Leicester Tiverton,
I'll thank you not to trouble me until you have something of interest to report,
he thundered. He was standing toe to toe with Inspector Archibond, who looked distinctly unhappy. Patrick Fairbrother stood a little apart, clearly torn about intervening in his employer's verbal brawl with a member of the Metropolitan Police.
Certainly, Sir Leicester,
Archibond said in clipped tones.
I thought only to keep you informed of the results of our investigation.
He began.
Results? What bloody results? You don't know anything. You have got no information out of Caroline de Morgan because she'll not see you. You haven't found de Morgan, and you haven't found my diadem. Until you do, you can go to—
The rest of what he said caused Lady Tiverton to intervene just as Inspector Archibond was opening his mouth, clearly bent upon expressing himself with vigour.
My dear,
Lady Tiverton said, laying her hand gently upon her husband's sleeve. He turned to look at her, having the decency to look heartily abashed.
Oh, I did not realise you were about. You either, Miss Speedwell,
he added, catching sight of me.
Apologies, ladies. I must add my own as well for being the cause of Sir Leicester's ill temper,
Inspector Archibond said thinly. Not at all, I said, baring my teeth in a smile. He turned to go, but suddenly swiveled back again, eyes narrowing.
Miss Speedwell? I believe you and I have a mutual acquaintance. Did I not see you in the company of Inspector Mornaday?
I was just trying to decide whether or not to lie to him when Sir Leicester broke in, crowing a little.
You ought to remember her name, Archibond. She will be a match for you, and no doubt about it. Miss Speedwell is investigating the disappearance of de Morgan with my diadem, and I'll lay you a guinea she beats you to the mark.
Is she indeed?
Archibond said, and it was not a question. He gave me a stern look.
I am certain I do not need to tell Miss Speedwell that this is, in fact, a police matter. Any interference on her part will be viewed as obstructive. Not if she finds my diadem,
Sir Leicester retorted.
Good day to you, Inspector.
With that, Sir Leicester gave him his congé, and Archibond departed, looking like thunder.
Of all the impertinence,
the Baronet complained, turning to his wife.
The largest vitrine arrived with a cracked glass. The nurserymen seem to think that date palms are the same as coconut palms and have delivered the latter. And there is a fault in the gaslights which simply cannot be tolerated. I am being driven to distraction and have had no help,
he finished peevishly. I thought that rather hard upon poor Mr. Fairbrother, but he merely grinned at me, ignoring Sir Leicester's ruffled temper. Lady Tiverton gave me an imploring look.
Miss Speedwell, I wonder if you would mind touring the hall with Mr. Fairbrother. There are a few matters I must attend to just now, and I fear they are rather pressing.
Certainly, I told her, and she hurried off with Sir Leicester, while Patrick Fairbrother smiled wryly at me.
You chose rather a dramatic moment to make an entrance, Miss Speedwell, he said.
Didn't I, though? He bent near, pitching his voice low enough that the Tivertons could not hear.
I am sorry about Sir Leicester landing you in it, though. I cannot think Inspector Archibond will take it at all well that you are involved in this investigation.
I shrugged. He did not seem pleased, but I have a great deal of experience at infuriating gentlemen. Now, introduce me to your collection, Mr. Fairbrother, and I promise to make suitably admiring noises. He led me into the great hall itself, a spacious area that had been furnished with an array of vitrines and pedestals for the display of the collection. Gaslights had been fitted, as well as the newest in ventilators. Shiny brass grills that ensured a bit of fresh air, even if they did spoil the impression of an Egyptian temple. A long gallery ran the length of one wall, while opposite it workmen were in the process of building a dais.
The sarcophagus of the princess will rest there. It will be quite dramatic when they finish, and the whole of the place will be hung with banners and decorated with potted palms, very atmospheric and suggestive of ancient Egypt, he told me.
He guided me to the few vitrines that were finished, the glass polished to a sheen, and the shelves lined with small goods from the find.
We have put out only the most minor artifacts at present, he told me. Wooden boxes, pottery bowls, that sort of thing. But there is quite a bit of jewellery, pretty beaded things, and one or two rather lovely statues.
It will be most impressive when it is finished, I assured him.
Nothing will be as impressive as the sarcophagus, he said. Would you like to see it?
It's here. Now? I looked around but saw nothing that resembled a coffin. He smiled.
The princess will not be coming into the exhibition proper until just before we open to the public. For now she is locked safely away. But I have the key, he said, brandishing it.
Beneath the gallery there was a long wall hung with draperies, and behind one of these lay a corridor, neatly screened from the main part of the hall.
These are storerooms along here, and that leads to the alley behind, he told me, nodding to a door at the end of the corridor. We cannot be too careful with security, so we've kept the place locked tighter than the Tower of London.
He fitted the key to the lock and threw the door open with a flourish. Behind lay a darkened chamber, and he moved into it, turning up the gaslight.
There. Behold our Princess Ankhesset, he instructed.
The sarcophagus was smaller than I had expected. It was crafted of gilded and painted wood, thickly decorated with hieroglyphs. At the head was the portrait of a woman's face, her gaze distant, as if she saw and heard only those things which were invisible and inaudible to mere mortals. One end of the sarcophagus was badly scorched, the ancient wood blackened by fire that had destroyed part of the cartouche, the gilded oval bearing the names and titles of the princess.
The bitumen, he said regretfully. Dreadfully pitchy stuff and flammable to boot. The ancient Egyptians used it sometimes to mummify animals, and there must have been an accident when our princess was being moved by the priests, because her sarcophagus was badly stained with it. Not surprising when you think of how improvised the whole thing was. Hauling her from a proper tomb in the middle of the night to avoid raising the interest of the thieves. It must have been a real hole-and-corner affair, very hush-hush, and everyone sworn to secrecy and working by the barest torchlight. It's a wonder anything at all survived. A stray spark from a torch fell when we were shifting her out of the cave and nearly sent the whole thing up. We only just managed to save her, thank God.
It was not heresy. He spoke with fervent gratitude.
Here you can just make out the more important bits of the cartouche, her name and honorifics.
He read them out to me, not quite touching the ancient wood with his finger.
And here is Anubis, guardian of the dead, protector of those who have moved to the afterlife, he added,
pointing to a familiar jackal-headed figure at the bottom of the sarcophagus. I can see why he would make for an alarming apparition, I told him. His face clouded a little.
It has indeed cast a shadow over our achievements.
I am sorry for it. Our fields are very different, but I can well imagine how such cruel tricks can blunt the pleasure of your accomplishments.
Thank you, Miss Speedwell. I am grateful for your kindness.
And Sir Leicester's, no doubt, I mused. It is surely a coup for so young a man to be afforded such responsibility in an expedition of this importance. He nodded gravely.
I have indeed been the beneficiary of Sir Leicester's generosity. By all rights, I ought to have toiled away for another few years under the tutelage of someone much more experienced.
He hesitated, his expression slightly abashed.
I must say I was rather surprised when Sir Leicester handed over so much authority to me this year, but with all the difficulties with the workers and the loss of Jonas Fowler, I think he found it a bit overwhelming at times.
He must have great faith in your abilities, I said lightly. He grinned, a singularly charming expression.
I don't know about that,
he told me, his manner self-deprecating in the most attractive fashion.
I still have much to learn about hieroglyphics and Egyptology in general.
Did you go to school for this sort of thing? I inquired.
No, I did not. My formal education was a makeshift affair. My family were poor, Miss Speedwell. Genteelly so, but my mother married badly and my father abandoned his family. My sister and I were left to shift for ourselves.
I am sorry, I began. He held up a hand.
Don't be. As much as I hated it at the time, the vagaries of my childhood forced me to be resourceful and to appreciate what I have.
Your mother and sister must be very proud of your success.
My mother did not live to see it,
he told me with a wistful look.
And I do not see my sister nearly as often as I would like. But I owe her everything. She worked tirelessly to find sponsors to pay for my education, to clothe and feed me, and give me the proper introductions so that I could make something of myself. Unfortunately, that sort of catch-as-catch-can education leaves much to be desired. I am constantly finding things I wish I had learnt properly in school. But Sir Leicester is patient with me. He is determined to see in me a sort of successor he can groom.
An heir apparent, I suggested.
Heir presumptive,
he corrected with a rueful smile.
There is still Figgy.
A somewhat thorny child.
Who has scratched me badly enough to draw blood once or twice,
he admitted.
Metaphorically speaking, she doesn't hate me quite enough to resort to physical violence. Oh, I should not jest. She does not hate me, not really. There are times when we are almost friendly. But she is wildly immature, and her father's affection for me is a sore point.
I can well imagine. But perhaps in time she will come to appreciate your finer qualities. He blushed an enchanting rose pink to the tips of his ears. He was standing near to me, a necessity when pointing out the small figures on the sarcophagus, and he seemed suddenly to recollect it. He straightened.
Forgive me. I ought to have considered the possible impropriety of inviting you here. Most ladies would have come over with an attack of the vapours, but I suspected that you—
He broke off suddenly, and I hastened to reassure him. You judged, quite rightly, that I am every bit as much a scientist as a woman. I am intrigued by your work, Mr. Fairbrother, and heaven protect me from missishness.
You are very understanding. But still we ought to join the others before Lady Tiverton suspects I have eloped with you to Gretna Green,
he said lightly. Do people still do that? What a delightfully old-fashioned notion of sin you have, Mr. Fairbrother. He locked the door carefully behind us, and we rejoined the Tivertons. Her ladyship appeared to have everything well in hand, including her husband. Sir Leicester's ruffled feathers had been smoothed, and he was deeply immersed in directing the workmen as to the proper installation of the dais. Lady Tiverton broke away and hurried over to me.
"I hope Patrick has been an instructive host," she said with a smile.
"Very much so. He introduced me to the Princess Ankeset. I must confess it is the first 18th Dynasty sarcophagus I have seen, and I found it most impressive."
"There are better examples," Fairbrother said with a wry twist of his lips. "But we are fond of her."
Lady Tiverton gave him an appraising look.
"Yes, well, I am certain that our princess will cause quite a stir. Patrick, Sir Leicester requires your assistance. There is some confusion about the decoration of the dais.
Mr. Fairbrother inclined his head to me.
Duty beckons, Miss Speedwell. Good day to you, and I hope we will see you at the exhibition.